Oh, this is pretty amazing that we got this many people back after all that long break here. I had a question or a reminder that I had failed in my explanation or description of what happened with the Joey thing was that Ellen and her husband have gone and visited Joey and her family already. And so that connection's been made. And how cool is this? See her, you know, she went out originally and stayed with her brother in Sacramento to have that baby. And that brother is not there any longer, but his son is. So there's a family member there. They got cousins and uncles and everything else all around them. So they got to go to a family barbecue together and all that kind of good stuff. So yeah, go
ahead. I know you said that she was familiar with the program because of everything. Were you able to make amends with her as well? Or?
To the extent that We'll be talking about amends here shortly, and I'll go into at least what my experience and my view of that has been. And yeah, that's the main point I would make just at this point is my teaching has been and my experience has been it doesn't work when I act like I'm part of an AA SWAT team and I'm gonna, you know, kick your door down and freeze. I'm gonna amend your ass. And so, well, sometimes in our it really is important because we get in these workshops and we get wound up and we get on fire and we especially once we start to have some good experience, and sometimes it's my experience. It, without meaning to, it's easy to outrun my coverage, and so this is in the area of 8 and 9 is one of the areas where I really lean heavily on sponsorship, and I also sponsor in there pretty heavily too. So anyway, before that, we've got some. A few more steps before we're there. So,
Leslie.
Did you have a
question?
We got a question.
Oh, excuse me.
At what point does a resentment or a fear or a sex conduct inventory, at what point does it become like necessary to write down? So, like, at what point does fear or resentment or sex conduct justify like a paper writing down rather than step 10. So does that make sense? At what point does it cross the line to, okay, I need to write it in?
Well, probably if I've got to ask myself the question. that's an answer in itself. But here's, you can have, there are different views on this, of course. But what works for me is that I'm very active in 10th step. I love 10th step, as described in the big book, and so forth. So I think of it in terms of like dental health. It's very important for me to floss and brush and rinse and gargle and all that stuff on a daily basis to maintain good health. With all of that, I still need to go have a professional in-depth cleaning once or twice a year. So with it, all my 10th step is very good, but what it sometimes will lack for me that a larger inventory is it won't put everything in context. I've got a piece here and a piece here and a piece there, and maybe I thoroughly, quotes, dealt with it in the moment. But what sponsors and others have pointed out to me is, oh, look, there's a pattern here, Oh, you seem to... There seem to be some threads connecting all of this that I miss if I don't look at it. One of the way, if you ever want to mess with an alcoholic, I know you, none of you would, but if you ever feel like you just kind of like to mess with an alcoholic, let them think they've done some unnecessary work. Oh, that's really good inventory. I didn't really think you needed to write that, but, you know. It's, I remember when I was a young man, a guy got a resentment at our local Chevy dealer, and they had some back and forth, and the mechanic had had enough with him down there, so he just took a screw and left it, one screw that didn't even belong to the car, and inside one of the doors of that car. And that screw rattled around for eons in there before it was ever found, you know, and just, oh my God, I did extra work. Oh God, I did unnecessary work. So anyway, that's my experience with it. Now I've got good friends and people that I respect that will say, look, you just work the first 9 steps one time, and then after that we're living in 10, 11, and 12, and I respect their program, their results. I think it's kind of maybe how we're individually wired to think about it. We have different people will learn and communicate in different ways, and so whichever one of those ways your sponsor recommends or you find effective for you to get the results. And at the end of the day, the results are what matter in there. If you're living in peace and you're satisfied, or you've got a functional connection with power greater than yourself, then yeah, I wouldn't tell you to change that in any way. So that's my experience.
Yes, I agree, Mike. Sponsorship is so helpful with looking at some of these things, because they're so close I can't see them. And it seems that there are, as time goes on, there are things that, like weeds in the yard, that seem to grow fast. And I see that, and it's like, why is everything else is just, like, it seems to be able to, I can deal with it on a daily basis. But this, it seems like I cut it down, and it just grows 10 minutes later, and what's happening with that? And so it's helpful to take another look. But then there are things that just come up and sideswipe me. I was trying to think of one. And I think, you know, I remember my, I'd made amends with my parents. And I just still felt like the short bus daughter, you know, I'm an only child, and I just felt like so disappointed them, you know. I didn't have any kids, and never got married, and all this trouble, and just laid waste to everything in the family. We have a small family, and so I make amends, but I still never felt like I was worthy, you know, for lack of a better word. Even though my mother, we love you, and we're so glad you're sober, and you're wonderful, and thank you so much, and I'd show up for things, but I just never felt worthy. And I remember saying to my sponsor, they treat me like I'm a child. You know, my father would, just the way he talked to me about money and that kind of thing. And she said, that's because you act like a child. And I didn't know. That was really true. That I really still sort of, you know, and I think a lot of it was that sort of that shame and unworthiness that I still have to be sort of under them in a way. And that started to reverse just by looking at that. And actually, you know, putting some stuff down. What am I afraid of? What's still underneath that I haven't cleaned out? And then when things really started to change when they got sick, you know, and they started to experience stuff, and I showed up as a daughter in a way that I never had before, like an adult. And so, you know, it is important to have someone else, and it may not necessarily be a sponsor, but, you know, my AA posse that I've given, you know, essentially, Charlie calls it spiritual permission, I think, to
consent, yeah.
A spiritual consent that you can talk to me if you see me driving off the rails. Help me. You know, if you love me, help me. Let me know. I'm not going to shoot at you. You know, it's safe to tell me stuff. So, follow your heart. Yeah.
My dear Linda used to always use the image. She says, she talked about standing there with eggshells scattered all around her waiting for you to step on one. And, you know, we can, without saying a word, we can be pretty well defended. And we can make it pretty clear when we're open to hearing something and when we're not. And that's a reflection I have to have on myself, because Linda, everybody that's known me closely will talk about in one way or another about my multiple personalities. You know, we've got sober Mike, and then we've got my evil twin Skippy, you know, or Keith, you know, and Bob, some of the couple of guys I sponsor in the home group, their code to let me know that I'm going that way, and they've got permission to do it, say, oh, looks like Sergeant Lorenz came to the meeting tonight, you know, and dealing with Sergeant Lorenz is entirely different than dealing with Mike, member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So one of the images, since we're kind of down this rabbit trail a bit, I use is one of my experiences was as a young man, I was in your great state at a place called Benning's School for Boys, otherwise known as Fort Benning, and we're a bunch of young, I'm 19, almost 20, and we're down here, and we want to jump out of airplanes, and we're excited, and we're macho, and all this kind of good stuff. And part of that training that we just, almost to a man, thought sucked was they made us learn how to pack parachutes. You know, and so you'd have to go in this hangar, and they'd have these big long tables, and you know you'd fold this and move this and do all this kind of stuff. And the way it, like you learn anything else, the first time you did it, it took like maybe 40 minutes to do one, and then before you know it, it's bang bang bang, they're done. Well, you get very unconscious after a while. We're just doing this as a side activity. And then one day, this old grizzled sergeant, who was older than dirt, probably almost 30 years old, he says, hey, you men, those chutes you just packed, grab them. We're going to go jump them. And now I've got a whole new vision of that deal. Uh-oh, did I... And see, that's what I'm doing, whether I know it or not, every day in Alcoholics Anonymous. On good days, I'm packing the chute, because there's going to be the day the girl I'm going to marry dies. There's going to be the day the kid I love gets thrown in jail. There's going to be the day that I get let go at my job, or the market tanks, and I all that kind of stuff. And sooner or later, I've never seen anybody in AIDS, one day we're going to get to jump that chute. And all I've done is slung a bunch of slogans, you know, and I was really good about, oh, well, you just need to turn that over. Well, I'm Ann Nelson. Ann's 5 years ahead of me, and I, for a nanosecond, sponsored her ex-husband, and her ex-husband came over to her apartment where she was living with a shotgun and terrorized her and the four kids she had with him and everything else. And she was a meeting completely distraught about this. And yours truly had the nerve when she got through sharing all this, and of course the women are descending on her with Kleenex, and I, big dummy, said, well, you know, you just need to show up and do some more service work. And she reminds me every year on her anniversary that, you know, in God's mercy, she let me live and didn't rip my face off there. But see, that was the time before I didn't have any other answer. Oh, somebody holds a shotgun and he holds you hostage and everything else. Do some more service work. Don used to say, you know, there is a legitimate use for tough love around here. But he says the fact is that most of us are much better at the tough part than the love part. And so I got to look at even if there is truth or a kernel of truth in the solution, am I applying this with compassion? Because if I'm not, then I'm just another bully with a spiritual slow. In fact, might be doing more harm than somebody else there. So just a couple of images to roll with. So I better shut up and let Leslie get going.
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. Yes, I guess we're going to talk about the fifth step a little bit. Who hasn't done a fifth step ever in here? Okay, excellent. Excellent. Well, you're in for a treat, let me tell you. and obviously you want to do the four in front of it, but...
it's kind of like a colonoscopy prep.
You know, I was kind of I remember telling Rita I was looking down the road at having to make amends, and I was just terrified. I thought, oh man, you know, if I go back and have to make amends for this, then they're going to know that whole thing was a lie, that situation, and that I really did sleep with my boss, and they're going to go, which they suspected, and then they're going to go around, they're going to tell everybody else, and everybody's going to know. And mind you, that was something I'd done in Indianapolis, and I'm now living in Louisville, so I don't even see those people. And I'm going down the road. She said, "Well, are you on the ninth step?" And I thought, "God, she's old. She doesn't remember. She has too many sponsees." But I think she was just that she knew, and she's just saying, "Honey, you know, when you get there, when you get to the ninth step, you'll have all the tools you need to get there. Right now, let's just look at what you have right now." And so there was also a part of me that just sort of wanted to throw it all up, that just wanted to just purge and get it all out. And so, you know, I showed up with my spotty fourth step, and she helped me with a lot of it, and there was a lot of insight. So I show up on a Saturday afternoon, you know, with all my stuff. And I just kind of blurted it out, and what she did was she just sat there. She said, "Just read it to me." And this isn't what I do personally, but this is just my first one. And, I mean, this isn't how I listen to a fifth step, but she listened, and she'd ask questions and get some clarification. And after I had finally, you know, after she had sort of helped me with some of these things, she, like the big booming voice of God, she looks right at me and says, "Is there anything else?" And I thought, oh, wow, I don't know, because I'll spontaneously combust if there is. And I'm just doing a quick search of my heart, and I think, no, there isn't. There isn't anything. Now, a whole bunch of stuff would come up later, you know. I remember moving back to Indianapolis, and I was at a shopping center at the mall, and like all of a sudden, I saw somebody, and all of a sudden this flood of memories came, and I thought, oh, yeah. There was that whole group of people that I used to hang out with and all of that stuff that we did. And so there was stuff to clean up. But, you know, my subsequent fifth steps have been really just a whole lot of listening, and then my sponsor shares with me a story very similar. Very similar. Yeah, I'm like that, too. I'm like that, too. And it you know, I didn't realize that. I mean, my sponsor was, she lived on the nice side of town, and I met her at the, what I call, it was a club, but it was on the side of town where, I call them the Gucci meetings, because it was my impression that all the women had Gucci bags and Cadillacs, and they didn't drink like me. You know, they spilled their whiskey sours on their Oriental rugs, and that's why they were here, and you know, and then the story started coming out. You know, I'd hear their lead or something, and they'd talk about, you know, offering sex to the cop when they got stopped so they wouldn't have to, you know, go to jail, and leaving the kids outside during the tornado because they were so focused on their booze and cigarettes. And I thought, wow, they really do drink like me. And, you know, it was kind of when I realized that you guys were just like, all this stuff that's in here is just like yours. I mean, the stories are different, but it's still my attempt to manage my life and to wrest satisfaction if I just manage well. And I was really bad at it. So I'll tell you from the other side of the... Now, so I did that on a Saturday, and then I went home, and I said, nothing really felt like... I thought, okay, good, that's a relief. I'm glad I got that all out. And I woke up the next day, and sleep is wonderful. Sleep is so cathartic, I think. And I think that's probably why I sleep so well now. But and it's, you know, on page 86 where we talk about when we retire at night and all those things that we do, you know, in the 11th step and reviewing what happened, you know, what asking ourselves these questions and how did it go today in my life, that it sort of just sort of lets everything, you know, kind of off. It's offloading all of this junk, and then I can sleep beautifully. But anyway, I wake up in the morning and I go to this that tradition meeting that I told you about. It's Saturday at 9 or Sunday at 9 o'clock. And it's like I jumped up and I took a shower and I ran down there and I ran up the stairs and I sat in the meeting. I was late so I had to sit in the back. I had to sit in the little thing back here. And the meetings had everybody's facing this way and I'm sitting back here and sitting cross-legged because I don't have a chair. And then the way they do it, you raise your hand and somebody calls on you if they know your name or write down a description, and they just make a little list and they call on you. And they were talking about the, you know, eighth tradition or whatever. And I said, well, I don't have anything to share about the eighth tradition. I don't know anything about the eighth tradition. But I just did my fifth step yesterday, and I feel like $1 million. And they all turn around, and they're all clapping, you know. And I felt like, and this is me. I hear this a lot, but I hear other people, it didn't do anything for me. But I felt like I was in Alcoholics Anonymous then. It's like when I gave my fifth step, I'm in now. I'm a member of AA. But you know what I do now with women that I sponsor, and I'll tell you, I've been all over the map. I don't know that I know how to do it. I think the most important thing I do is say a prayer before we sit down. And I often say a prayer before we do anything, before I open my mouth, especially when it feels like I'm in a position that somebody's looking at me and they want to hear a message other than what's rolling around in my head. And so I'll say a little prayer. God, show up here. You know, you're up. It's just let me be an instrument of thy peace. And then I trust that whatever happens is supposed to happen. And I listen. There are times that the first sponsee I had a male family member molest her when she was about 5 years old. And she was angry. I mean, and there it is. And so she's telling me all about it, and it gets into, you know, my mistakes. And I think she might have put my part. I might have been saying my part at that time. And she said, well, I don't have a part. I mean, she's all prepared, too. Like, if you think there's something I'm going to put there, you better think again. And she was angry. And I thought, and I remember, you know, looking at that and thought, well, yeah, I mean, yeah, you don't have a part in that. I didn't know what to do with it. And I thought, well, there should be something there. So I go back to Rita. We just skipped that. And I go back to Rita and I told her what I just told you. And she said, well, you know, how old is she? Oh, I don't know. She's 28. And so this has been, what, 22 years? I said, yeah. She said, well, you know, she continues to hold on to this, right? And I thought, but yeah, I mean, but it's still, you know, but she's a victim. She's continuing to take this and pet it. She's just petting it, and she's holding it close, and it's comforting her in some way. And the trick is to let it go, because I can't just let it go. Because if
she needs to do some service work. Yeah.
Exactly. But it continues to hold, you know, when I hold something on in like that, it continues to hold me in captivity. I mean, the jailer, I'm the jailer, right? And I'm making sure that my prisoner stays where they need to be. And the thing is that there's this part of me that almost feels like if I forgive them, they get away with it. And I thought, they got to pay. But me just holding it all inside and all that venom, you know, and I remember Rita said this. She said, having a resentment is like taking poison, waiting for the other guy to die. Mm-hmm. And I heard that. I heard that when she said that. Now, I didn't have that kind of thing, but, and you know, I don't remember what happened when I went back to talk to this gal now. I don't remember if she was angry and just said, screw you, or if she, I don't remember what happened. I remember what happened with me, though. And, you know, this is another thing. A fifth step is a two-way street. There are times that I sit and somebody will, there was a gal that was talking about how she was mistreating her husband and she wasn't paying attention to him and all the stuff that she did. She was drinking up his paycheck and all of this. And some of the things that her husband was telling her, you know, you just don't pay attention to me. I wish that your sponsees, when they called you, the women that called you, I almost want to get on the phone and call you and like be one of your sponsees. I'm so and I had, my girlfriend told me the same thing. you know, I wish you'd talk to me the way you talk to them. And so she's saying that, and I'm like, oh, yeah, so what'd you do about that? What'd you find? You know, because it's like news to me. I completely, completely missed it. So, man, Mike, I had another thought, but I lost it for now. I'll let you pick it up.
So we're going through this whole, been going through this whole process, and it's important for me to recenter on what it is I'm trying to do. And so much of us, especially once we're into, if we've done multiple inventories and we're getting into it, we get very good at this. You know, I start to become inventory slick. I can get it on paper and make it sound right and make everything line up, and you know, General Service would like to, you know, send it out to, as a PDF for distribution across the fellowship, and here's how it ought to be. But see, that's not what I'm looking for here. I am missing the mark if I think what I'm trying to do is get the right information that I can use to fix myself. If I'm really successful here, I'm going to get a real dose of hopelessness. And the hopelessness is going to be that Mike is never going to fix Mike. No amount of information, no amount of insight, no amount of detail. Mike was not designed to fix Mike any more than that BMW was designed to fix itself. You got to take it to the dealer. The dealer is the one that's got the parts and the software program that can read the diagnostics and everything else. This is part of me becoming entirely convinced here. And once it was laid on me, okay, Mike, what we're doing is we're just tapping the nails in the coffin of your ego here, so you understand that you aren't going to fix yourself, but you're becoming willing to have yourself fixed. Now I'm becoming, when I, you know, maybe some of you, something happens. It happened with a yard trimmer with Jess and I the other weekend. Boy, before I was willing to go to Lowe's and get the new part, I tried to fix it. You know, I spent some time. I dismantled this thing. I'm looking on YouTube. I'm going here. I'm going there. I'm trying to get all kinds of information to avoid doing what I, in my heart, knew I was going to eventually have to do to get this done. And like Les was talking about before, kind of one of the messages I thought I got, I don't know that it was actually given to me, was that if you're a real man, you fix it yourself, by God. If you break it, you fix it. If you do, you know, whatever, you know, pull yourself up by the bootstraps and you suck it up and you get going and all that kind of stuff. And none of that stuff works here, really. None of that really works. And so I'm going through this whole process. I want a real case of desperation coming out of here. And I've got to have a reminder every now and then, because I, you know, after all, I'm Mike L. Surely Mike L. could fix this. And nope. What happens now today is I get to the point where I surrender much quicker on this stuff and tend to let go more quickly. I probably only spent 45 minutes trying to fix the trimmer before I just, you know, headed down to Lowe's and said, you know, here's the model number. I took a picture of it. What do you think? You know, I still have to resist. Part of me still, and probably always will, resist a little bit. because that part of me that wants to look at the problem, solve, that's not a bad part of me. That can be a very good, positive, constructive part of me. My problem is I misuse my gifts. I'm bringing the wrong tool to the job is the real problem. It's not that it's a useless tool and the bad tool and everything else, but I'm misapplying it. I had a hands-on experience with what Leslie was describing. I was at one of these workshops, and Don was doing it. And when I went to these, I always liked to sit in one of the side seats because I wanted to be able to watch him, and I wanted to be able to watch the crowd at the same time and see how the impact of what he was saying and doing landed with them. And he got into that business about, you know, my mistakes, and there was this gal there, and she was very goth, black combat boots, black everything, you know, whatever, and she just launched out of her chair, and she said, you know, my grandfather raped me when I was 7 years old. Now tell me what the hell mistake I made in that. And it was very much like Don said, well, first of all, the old son of a bitch ought to be horsewhipped, you know. And then went into similar to what Leslie said about, you know, but honey, you've been hanging on to this for a lot of years. And he pointed out to her, he says, it's like the game of telephone or around the room. You know, you keep telling yourself the story, and you keep telling yourself the story that you're injuring yourself with today isn't even what actually happened. It's the 500th telling yourself of what happened, and it shifts just a little bit every time, and we tend to put just a little more drama in everything else. And it was interesting. She wasn't initially very happy, but she stayed there. She was a young artist, and what I got to see over the years following that, because she did wake up, she started sending him little she once or twice a year, Don would get a watercolor from her, and he had them on the wall of her meditation room, and they went from one side to the other, and they started out very dark and nasty looking and everything else, and by the time we get over here, they're bright and sunshiny, they look like Monets, you know, and you can just look at that wall and watch somebody getting free and their spirit getting free in that thing. And what he told me was very much, when I asked him to help me with something, he says, well, why would you want me to do that? And I says, oh, Don, I need to get better. He says, no, I won't help you get better. He says, you've been trying to get better all your life, and it's brought you to this. He says, what you've never done is you've never tried to get free. He says, you're like a guy in prison, and you're not interested in getting out. You just want a nicer cell and more privileges. And so that's what we're looking at here. This is about getting free. Not about getting better. Not about just numbing up the pain a little bit until it comes back again. You know, a new drug that we can use. But this is about getting free. And getting free is a scary thing. If you've ever seen some of those World War II films that they took where they released people from some of the concentration camps, and those poor people stumbled out of their cells into the sunlight, and an amazing amount of them got out in the sunlight and turned around and walked back into their cells because it was just too bright for them. And I've watched that happen in here, where somebody gets free and it's just almost too much and they pull back in. That's part of my job as a sponsor and as a member, is to be watching for that and to be gentle with that person when they emerge into the sunlight and help them as they adjust to the new brightness that they're living in. So there's a lot of, I don't have a way of listening to a fifth step. I have some general principles, but you know, the fact is, I need to pay attention and be present for you is the first thing I need to do. It's a constant place. This is one of the places where I really feel the presence of my Creator, power greater than myself, whatever, is when I'm being entrusted with these precious things, some they're delicate things that we've carried and protected and been afraid of exposing and all of that for years and years. And it's interesting because some of the most sensitive ones I've encountered are the big tough guys, you know. You wouldn't want to meet them in an alley, but if you meet them over a fifth step, there's a real frightened little kid inside that big bad exterior, and we got to help that kid. Now I'm not doing therapy with him or anything like that, but I help to create as best I can, as God will show me how to create a safe spiritual space for them to give birth to their new life, because that's really happening. I'm just kind of midwifing a birth of a new life here. One of the things that we hear so often is that
there's only 13 lines or something like that in the big book about step 6 and 7. You know, you got...
No, there isn't. Think about this. We've spent all this time up here getting prepared and acquiring the information to make the decision and to create the willingness. I wrote an inventory. I fifth-stepped it. I exposed my soul to you. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I became convinced of my powerlessness. I believe that I'm willing to take a chance there might be a spiritual solution to what's been bothering me. That's all everything we've been doing has been leading up to here. This is just the cherry on the top of the sundae. But without the sundae, you know, there's no place for the cherry to go. That's it. So this willingness is a big deal. Am I utterly convinced that Mike can't fix Mike no matter... Now, right here, you know, if you've got other problems... And you're a sociopath or a psychopath, and there's some, you know, we were talking. I get interesting. I sponsor a guy who spends about half the year in Russia, and I get interesting Skype calls from Russia, because they're the Wild West of AA now, kind of, you know, and so you get a call from the Ukraine I had an abusive father. When I was 14, I helped my mother kill him, and we dismembered him and dropped his body parts down various storm drains in our city. I was wondering, do I need to make amends for this? And if so, what would they be?
And who would they be to?
Yeah.
And he's dead. Sorry for killing you.
And well, no, but you know, you gotta. This is a serious question, because he got in that trying to protect his mother. He was a 14-year-old way in over his head with a violent guy in a culture where the authorities weren't going to protect him. Now, we're not justifying this, but these are real spiritual dilemmas that we encounter. Not always, that's more dramatic than most. But these things are here. And so what do we do? And so this willingness, are we willing to step up? And the way I look at this, you know, is we talked about it last night, this business of informed consent. I have a God of informed consent. God wants to know that I know what I'm agreeing to, that I'm not just... See, in a lot of ways, I'm a spiritual litter bug. You know, what I wanted to do is, well, I'm going to say the magic third-step prayer and then the magic seven-step prayer and throw my garbage out of the window and keep going down the road and God will take care of it. You know. Oh, and then the promises will be all over me. You know. And ain't happening. You know. And thank God I had somebody that would slow me up enough. 6 and 7 are where I have my relationship with God in large part. And I got that image, we were talking about it in the meeting a week or so ago. I was up by trout fishing with Don up by Estes Park in a stream up there. And I got to go out and play with him from time to time. We're just, like I said, Big Brother and I are out fishing, and it's one of those fabulous days. We can't keep the fish off the hook. I mean, they're just bang, bang. These trout are hitting, and we're catching them, throwing them back, and all this kind of stuff. And I talked to Don, and I says, Don, I says, you know, what is it? You know, I have worked these steps as hard as I can. I've worked them over and over again, and as near as I can still, I still have all my defects. What the hell's going on? And he says, well, chuckles for a little bit. Yeah. First of all, the problem is you've been doing it the best you can. A gentle way of reminding me the best I can is not going to be sufficient for this deal. And then he says, Mike, what are you and I doing here today? And I says, well, hell, we're fishing. And he says, yeah, but not really. He says, this isn't, you know, we're catching these fish and maybe we'll keep a few for lunch, but we're throwing most of them back. He says, well, the fishing is just where you and I get together and get to hang out together and have this conversation. The fishing is the setting. And the same way with my defects of character. My defects of character where I really stay connected with my higher power. Now, I can tell you honestly, I still think I've got every defect I ever showed up with. Now, they don't show up in the same way. But they're all there. Ram Dass had gave a really nice image once. He says he was talking about it. He called them his demons, but he says my demons used to be like these roaring lions that would just slash me to pieces, and he says they're still all there, but they're mostly like kittens that play at my feet today. So they're still there, but the impact is different because of this connection here. And I loved one of the, Sandy Beach had a way of saying it that I could hear it, you know. He'd say, you know, what if God actually did remove all my defects of character? You know, he said, well, I'd be the most grateful guy in the world. He said, I'd recommend God to everybody. You know, you ought to try out this God stuff. He removed all my defects of character. And I'd be very grateful. And I'd probably even say a special prayer. Dear God, I am so grateful that you have removed all my defects of character. And I'm so grateful that I don't do this anymore. I'm so grateful that I don't do that. And Sandy would spin that out for a couple of minutes, you know. And then the finish punchline on that was, and most of all, I'm so grateful I really don't have to spend much time with your sorry ass anymore. See, if my defects were removed, honest to God, how much time would I spend? And how close would I be to that power? See, I don't even think defects are, if you like, shortcomings, if you like. But what I think they are, I think, you know, that BMW was designed to keep me at the dealers on a regular basis. The God of my understanding is at least as smart as a German automotive engineer. God wants a relationship with me. God was my creator and designer. And I think God knew how to keep me close. The same way that my mother used to know how to keep me close with the checkbook and the car keys and all this stuff. Most parents know and have a desire. Some are better at it than others, but no one want to keep their kids close to them. And if not their kids, at least the grandkids, you know, really, really want those kids around. So I get a different view of this all of a sudden, because when I was looking at it, that this was this forever struggle that I was failing at, and one more time, oh, I'm just it, here it is again, and I did it. Oh my God, I've lied again, and I've done this again, and I don't know about you, but sooner or later, I quit showing up for something I'm failing at. I really, you know, I would not, I'd like to tell you my character was better than that, but it isn't, you know. And eventually, I just kind of quit showing up, or I'm mailing it in, you know. It's kind of like these check the box in evening reviews where it can be a useful tool, but after a while, I'm just click, 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 yep, hit send. And I think I'm in some kind of a spiritual relationship, and I'm I might as well be making love to an inflatable doll is what I'm doing here. Yeah, it ain't real. Anyway,
That's why I love you. Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah. Thanks, Mike. So now I have to come to God, my little broken self. Here I am. I see where I'm up against the wall. And what you guys told me, and I heard this before. I mean, I started hearing this early on that God was going to be my sufficient substitute. And I just didn't see how that happened. How does that look on the road? What do you do? So I do the mechanical things, and I go to a meeting and call my sponsor and take somebody back to the Dove House and all of that. But I guess what I thought was sort of the same kind of check the box thing that I just want to. What's the system? You know, what is the method? Whether you learn how to bake a cake or wash your car, get sober, what is it that produces the results time after time so that when I do it, I'm just good at it? You know, I'm not so good at it the first five times. You know, the seventh, I'm getting better. The tenth, getting better. And now, about time 15, I can reliably recreate this to perfection. And, you know, I think that one of the messages I got was that it doesn't really roll that way. That really, it's not so much a pursuit of the method. I mean, there's steps. I work these steps, but they're interactive in a way that's messy, you know. So it's more helpful to show up with an attitude of faith and supplication and joy and reverence and expectation. You know, just bring the body and just bring my surrender. And where do we go from here? You know, and take this stuff and just sort of just put it on the altar, as it were, and say, here I am. But, you know, I feel so unworthy. And when that started, what started to change was that when I started to feel in my brokenness, well, I'll put it this way, Thomas Merton asked this interesting question. He says, so what if when you died, you discovered that God wasn't even interested in your spirituality, your method, my sitting and getting my chi all together. What if God wasn't even interested in your spirituality? What if the reason I'm so interested in my spirituality is that I'm afraid of the intimacy that God finds me precious in my brokenness, and it's just too much to bear. It's too intimate. So I decide to get spiritual because I can handle spirituality. What I can't handle is the divinity of my heart and its poverty. It's utterly unmanageable. It's you have all the control. And here I just pour myself into God, and what's that going to look like? I remember somebody made this, they talked about being in meditation and just being like this little bead of water, sitting in meditation. God was this big sponge, and God was getting closer and closer and closer. And it was like, no, I don't want to be sucked up into God. I want to keep my integrity. So, what you told me is that what I need is a spiritual practice, right? A spiritual practice like... basketball play. When they're shooting hoops just before the game, they're still playing basketball. It's practice, but they're still doing it. So I can't remember who it was, but I think one of the best definitions of a spiritual practice is a rendezvous with God, where the only mission is. I can't remember. It's a daily rendezvous with God, and one can make the argument that it's not just daily; that it's continuous. To what extent can I make it continuous? Thich Nhat Hanh, the Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, says you can meditate doing dishes. You just be present. You wash the dish and you're present. You're not thinking about, we're done with this and Law and Order is going to come on. I got to get the kids back. You're just right there washing it and feel the warmth of the water and just be right here, right now, breathing in God's love and breathing out fear and breathing in God's love and breathing out confusion and just being right here, right now. That's really hard to do. I have moments of that kind of thing. It's not as continuous as what I think the Dalai Lama and certainly some others, that they just live in this constant awareness of God. I get distracted. But I come and I make it, I'm serious about having a relationship with God, and I don't know how to do it. So I just ask, right? Just what you told me to do. I cry out from the wilderness, God, are you there? God, if there be a God, come to me. I remember a prayer from World War. It was a book of prayers from the battlefield. It was a World War I prayer, and it was something they found on this guy, and he'd written, God, come. Just come. Don't send your son. This is no place for children. Just come. And you can feel the desperation. And when I'm in that desperate place where I can't sit, on that bathroom floor, and that my first day of sobriety, it was that was all I could muster. Just come. I don't even know what to tell you to do. Here, take me. And man, that's a powerful prayer. That's like in the scary movies, those old scary movies where a bunch of teenagers would end up someplace when their car broke down and they go down in the basement of some scary house and they'd find all this stuff and there'd be like this book written in Latin and one idiot says, oh, I speak Latin. He starts reading and they're like, no, don't read the Latin. And then the spirits come and all kinds of things happen. That's what happens. God comes and it's scary to be free, to get on that magic carpet and let me take you. And, I'll say this, though. What I have found is my utter worthiness. I forget that. I still forget that today momentarily. But that God loves me wildly, absolutely wildly. I love Tarek and I were talking about some of these wonderful mystics that they write so beautifully. And I think it was Kabir that says something like, what kind of God would he be if he did not count the blinks of your eyes and be in absolute awe of their movements? And that's the kind of God that I want. You know, like a little baby. I don't have kids, but have you seen little babies of a certain age, like maybe 8 months, and you can cover their eyes like this, and you go like this, and they're like, ah, like it's the first time they've seen you, and you do it again, and they keep doing that every time. Like, it's like, wow, you're here. And it feels like that's how God is to me. I can turn my face away, and I go, and I go, and I do what I do, and it's like, oh, wait, I'm a child of God. And I turn around, and God's like, oh, Leslie, you're here. I love you. I love you. Let's go ride on your motorcycle. Let's do what I made you for. Let's, and God's with me all the time. I'm the one that runs it. And it's never, you know, this is like the 14th time you've done this thing. You know, when you keep saying, I won't do it again. God, I promise I won't do it again. And there you are. There you are, trashing your boss to the other employees. You said you wouldn't do it. So, no, you know, I mean, the time's racking up. Now it's 33 times. That's it. But, and you know, Mike has this wonderful story about his father and the difference between my earthly father and my heavenly father, as it were, you know, that God doesn't care. God doesn't care. God, I mean, God made me this way. And so it's absolutely fine. I will always be here, and I'll always take care of the mess for you. And, you know, when you feel that the first time and the second time and the third, and it just keeps amplifying, it's, I mean, I have 1,000 stories of those moments where the hair just, I remember walking down the street at the University of Kentucky. I got sober in Louisville, and like a lot of alcoholics, I wanted to go back to school, and I majored in philosophy. Where's my philosophy major? Yeah. And I majored in philosophy because I'm an idiot. And I'm not saying you are. I mean, I know what I was doing. Let me put it that way. Because I think if I know something, then I know something, and that I can take it from here and put it here. I don't know. So I'm walking on campus. And I'm walking on campus, and I don't know what it was. It was probably a grade, because I was all about my grades, and I'm just like, you know, I'm 5 years sober, you know, allegedly. I haven't had a drink in 5 years, and I'm walking, and I'm just pissed off about something, and why'd you bring me this far to drop me, and I don't believe this, and this is terrible. And in my life, and mind you, I have this wonderful job. I have 2 vehicles. I have a house. I'm going to school. I have this good job, and I have this wonderful, you know, group of friends, and I have recovery and all the outside stuff, And I'm just angry, just shaking my fist at God. And it's like, you know, can you just throw me a bone or something? You know, are you even there? Do you even care? You brought me this far. And I walk up, and I see this little red thing, and I get up there, and it's a gummy bear. And it's brand new, you know, and not like it'd been out all night and stepped on or anything. It was brand new, and it was looking up at me, like face up with that little dopey gummy bear grin, you know. And I'm looking down at it, and I'll tell you what, the clouds didn't part and God didn't speak, but I'll tell you what I heard. What I heard was, I got you, baby. I'm right here. And it was just woo, like a Busby Berkeley musical. You know, it was just everybody burst into song, and everything got brighter and lighter, and it was like, yes. You know, I could feel it deep down. And there was never a drug, and there was never a high, there wasn't anything that I produced myself in the fun department that compared to that. And man, you get a hold of some of that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it'll rock your world and show you want to come back for more. But it's not, you know, it's not easy. I mean, I can twist off that maker's mark, and I can be there in just a little bit. But sometimes God didn't work that fast. You know, sometimes it takes a little while, and it doesn't even look like it's going to happen. And then it doesn't happen the way I want it to. You know, I'm pretty sure what a gift looks like. You know, it has a steering wheel or a swimming pool or something like that. You know, it often doesn't look like a lost job. But, you know, I do it, and I trust, and I watch what happens. You know, and my sponsor gave me that permission. This is something that I tell girls that I work with and just people that I love. You know, do whatever it is. Should I do X or Y? You know, I'm at the fork in the road. Which way do I go? I don't know what's good for you. But go and pick one. You know, say a prayer. Say, God, help me out here. I can either, you know, go left or go right. And I really don't know which way. And so I'm going to sleep on it, say this prayer, and I'm going to trust that the next thing I'm just going to pick one. and trust. And, you know, just go with it. And pay attention to what happens. And if you end up where the road's under construction and it's nightfall and it's terrible and you know all the jungle animals are coming out, then you know that maybe, you know, what's that? It's like playing darts. You know, what's that motion when you listen to your gut and you feel it? You know, that intuition. What's that motion when you hit the bullseye? Ooh, what's that? And you just keep doing it. You keep doing it and you zero in on it. And that's how it's been for me. That's how it's been. Stop there.
I love you.
I love you.
She reminded me of the story with my dad that helped me shift concepts here, and I was stuck in because I didn't have anything. I loved my dad. My dad was one of my heroes, and so I didn't perceived that I had any problem with, quotes, God the Father. And then through a process, I got walked back into a place where I'm sitting at the kitchen. I'm back from Nam. I'm back a while. I'm sitting at the kitchen table with my dad. And he's a businessman in that small town, that small college town. And we're sitting there, and there's a pile of my bad checks between us because there weren't credit cards in that time. And so what I'd done is I'd gone around to his friends and written bad checks, you know. And my dad is looking there, and my dad went to school. The way he got to college was on a football scholarship playing tackle, and so he wasn't a little wuss. And that big guy's looking across the table at me, and he's not angry. He's got tears in his eyes. And he says, "Son, I love you more than anything in the world, and I would do anything in the world to help you. But it seems the more I try and help you, the worse you screw things up. What in the hell am I supposed to do?" Broke his heart. See, and what I didn't realize that I was kind of with God the Father then, and I heard God saying to me, "Look at all I've done for you. I've given you money. I've given you careers. I've given you relationships. I've given you a marriage. I've given you I've saved your life in the war. I've saved your life from alcoholism, and you keep screwing it up. What am I going to do?" See, it was perfectly rational for my human father to react that way. But when I took that and transposed that onto higher power, then I, without realizing it, I'd put myself in a place where I was beyond help here. And I needed to shift that up. So frequently these little spiritual misunderstandings or incorrect visualizations, they're kind of like a rock below the surface in the lake. You can't see them, but they'll take the bottom of your boat out quicker than anything. So when I'm stuck, I kind of, what is it I'm not seeing here? What is it I can't quite see? And especially these days, I often get my answers from you. You know, I don't necessarily need to call some guru, you know. I need to go sit in the, one of the things Don had me do, as a matter of fact, I called up to complain about a certain meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous where they were killing the alcoholics, in my opinion, you know. Completely insane structure. And just saying, and everything else, and I was very well justified and laid it out for him. He says, "Huh, well, you could be right about that." He says, "Now, I expect you to have two of those bad meetings on your schedule every week." I expected an entirely different. I mean, he was a former trustee. He was going to throw down, and here's let General Service know about him, and I'll call my friend. You know, but nope. He says, "Mike, He says, they don't need you in a good meeting. They need you in a bad meeting. And it's not to try go there and try and change the meeting. But he says that bad meeting is like a trout pond that's stocked with suffering alcoholics that aren't getting what they need. Now, you're not going to be able to catch all the fish, but it's a perfect place. If you'll go there and pay attention, you can find one here and one there and one over there and help. And just how many people would you have to help in order to make it worth your while, you know? Oh, another dig at my ego, you know? I want to do all this stuff. And so I've continued that practice over the years in general, and it's interesting today I get to sit in those meetings and, oh, that's what 1 year sober Mike looked like. Oh, that's what... See, I get to see myself and understand myself in a way I never did before because my memory is very selective. I was much better informed and much cooler and had a much better program than I actually did have. That's what my memory tells me. And the first time I ever got recorded doing anything, I was about 5 years sober, and I periodically will go through the very uncomfortable exercise of listening to that, just so I can realize, you know, I thought I was standing there telling the truth, and there's probably 10% of that, as I listen to it now, that's true. And the rest of it was some compilation of old ideas, bullshit, and rationalizations, you know. And I got to see, oh, okay. So I get to look at the person in the bad meeting with a new sense of compassion, and not with this disdain that, hey, I'm going to straighten you out, buddy. It's, oh, I get where you are. Yeah, I've been there too. And so not everybody wants help. They're happy the way they are. But it placed me in a place to be useful from time to time. So I think we're coming up on dinner break, and we've run for about an hour now. So let's take a break, and we'll come back go ahead.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay. This will be the first time I do a fifth step.
Yeah.
All right. And... you know, I think about it sometimes, and I say, okay, I'm going to be fine doing this because I'm going to go to the same page with my higher power when I start talking. And I'm sitting here listening to you guys, and I realize something that I have farted around forever with my fourth step. And maybe that's because I don't really want to get to a fifth step. I mean, I started three times.
Yeah.
I have every reason in the world. I get up, I go play with the dog, I go to my mom's house and watch my dad with dementia. I do everything in the world, but I'm not finishing that fourth step, okay? And where I'm going with this is, like, I want to be as free as I can with this entire experience. Is it beneficial? Tara shared earlier about there's a monk here who listens to fifth steps, okay? Obviously, I'm going to do this with my sponsor, okay? Is it beneficial to do this with more than one person the first time you do it, especially somebody I consider pious, you know? Yeah. I want both of you next to me.
I'd say that sounds true. And what we're talking about with this particular monk who's also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I would like to do a fifth step with him. I think that it is a tradition in the group that I'm part of that you kind of do it with a lot of people and you get another perspective, you know. I don't have kids, so some of this stuff is going to fall on some, you know, talking to somebody else who has kids, then she'll be able to get some different feedback and just a different perspective from different people. Well, I don't want to share my opinion. I mean, I have some opinions about doing fifth steps with different people. I think whatever your heart leads you to do can probably be useful in some way, whether it turns out the way you thought it that it should, or you got something out of it, or you just completely hit the wall. It's all a learning experience. I'll tell you one thing I do with sponsees is that we start reading this book. We start at the beginning, and then when we get into We Agnostics, I just have them start writing down the first two columns of a resentment inventory. And then, especially if there's something burning them up right now, my husband, and why don't we just write this down right now, kind of go through it and diffuse a little bit of that. But I model it for them. I mean, I keep a four-step with me, and I'll do one if I have something that I think I can kind of expand into that, then, you know, we'll kind of go through and look at what's really going on here, and especially what's it costing me? What does this affect? You know, what am I, is it high blood pressure? I can't go in that store now because she works there, so I don't know if that would be helpful to just sort of maybe do one or two with your sponsor, but that sounds great, getting with the monk AA personally. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, and again, see, when I'm trying to manage a spiritual process, we're talking about futility here anyway. One of the reasons somebody, in fact, several times I've been asked some of the stuff I share in here and stuff, they go, my God, why do you say that in public? And, you know, well, the reason I say that in public and we'll read something like that inventory with Ellen is I've been set free of that. And if I really am free, but I'm treating it like this, what's that say? So I get free of this. And the more I share this stuff, the freer I get. Now I tell somebody, don't worry about doing the perfect fourth or fifth step. Just go do a bad one, you know. But keep doing them. You know, the first time, it's kind of like if you're the first time you were going to get up and play your instrument in the orchestra of life here, you know, would you expect to, you know, be like Louis Armstrong? I don't think so. So here's, just be willing to get up and then be willing to get up and do again. See, here's the easy tip to make AA easy for me in my experiences. I quit trying to do AA well enough so I could escape AA. I quit trying to do the steps good enough so I didn't need to do them again. So I don't need to really do them. I'll show up and teach you from time to time. But I don't really need to play the game anymore. You know? No. No, they're continuous. What the steps are for me is they're a problem-solving method. If you go to law school, there's a legal method of analysis and the way a legal approach to the problem. If you're in other disciplines, there will be ways you approach a problem and take it apart and deal with it. Here's a spiritual process just like that. We don't have to. One of the beautiful things my former wife used to say with that beautiful smile, she'd say, honey, isn't it wonderful that every time we have a new problem, we don't have to find a new solution? We already have a solution. And she's 34 years sober, so only 33. So, you know, here's the deal. You know, go ahead and do them. See, the second one, with the second person, will be more relaxed and more relaxed and more relaxed. And I don't know what I'm doing for the person that I'm sharing with. People that have shared inventories with me have awakened things in me that, I didn't know that was a problem. So, anyway, we've outrun our coverage here, and time to go for dinner. We'll see you after dinner. Thanks.